This week, Grizzle had the pleasure of speaking with Phil Back, the CEO of Armada ETF Advisors, to discuss his outlook on the state of the U.S. banking system and how today's current investment environment differs from the past. He also discusses potential risks facing the private REIT sector and what entrepreneurs need to know when it comes to starting a business.
We're excited to have Phil back here. If for those who don't know him, he's the CEO of Armada ETF Advisors. So thank you, Phil, for joining us this Friday.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
I know that right now markets seem to be pricing in that, you know, banking issues are stabilizing and there's not as much stress in the system as thought, but you've been very vocal about the financial risk we've seen in the market this year. And I pinned your tweet up at the top. I don't know if you can elaborate on a bit more, but you said 15 years after the global financial crisis and our banking system is still as fragile as ever. Central bank investors gave us temporary rising asset prices and nothing else. The system is failing. We must reestablish free market principles while we still can. What is your outlook on the market basically just kind of like ignoring this and kind of nothing changing from, you know, what happened in 08? Like there's no accountability to, you know, banks mismanaging assets or can you elaborate on that?
So you might think from that tweet, you might think that that's a bearish tweet, but in fact, it's actually a bullish tweet, or at least, you know, short, medium term bullish, because, you know, what I'm saying is that free markets, water always finds the lowest level, right? And markets, you know, any asset will eventually, on a long enough time frame, find its intrinsic value. What's the price that somebody's willing to come in and buy it, right? And even in a market crash, an asset that has, you know, that has book value, you've got, you know, you're a factory, you've got machines, you've got, you know, customers, whatever you have, someone will come in and buy up for the value of the components if the asset is trading lower than the components are worth. There's a real value there. There's a hard value. Financialized assets are a little different. And that's where like all these bubbles that the Fed keeps blowing up keep happening in these financial assets. And, you know, what I'm saying there is if we don't have free markets, if the, you know, the Fed and they're going to have, you know, QE infinity and ZIRP and all these different policies that they're going to come in and rescue the day every time that there's a market issue, then we don't have price discovery in the markets. We don't have free markets. We have managed markets. And managed markets, if I had to put my money anywhere, that's where I would put my money. It's actually a bullish tweet, and it's a fact. It's a fact of how the markets are. The Fed is coming in at increasing intervals, increasing timeframes, with increasing amounts of money for diminishing returns on their initiatives. So it's pretty scary. I mean, it all works great until it doesn't, until it crashes. But, you know, I don't know when or if that'll ever happen. But the fact is, the way the markets act today is not the way natural organic markets should work.
And I think that's a really good point you make. And you know, you've been in the ETF industry for 15 years. You used to be a managing director, for those that don't know, at the New York Stock Exchange. And you put this tweet up that I also want to post in the Nest. And you were like, a risk manager doesn't hedge duration. A tweet sets off a bank. Rates are still below their historical means. These aren't monumental events. These aren't black swan events. If the system is too fragile to endure, the system is too fragile to save. It wasn't always like this. It wasn't always about whether some suits in a closed door meeting decide if banking confidence or inflation is the bigger issue they need to save. We used to buy companies. We used to buy the future cash flows of real companies that we believed in. Why do you think, like, how is this market different from the past? What do you think changed? Because I think that's a really interesting point.
So after the global financial crisis, you know, the Fed came in, you know, they slashed rates and they did quantitative easing, right? To a lesser degree, by the way, than like QE4 and QE5, but they did quantitative easing. And there was this narrative afterwards that, you know, Bernanke saved us, saved the financial system. We're all saved. There are a bunch of heroes at the Fed. If not for them, we'd all be destitute and poor and, you know, everything would have gone to shit, but they saved it and the issues are in a rearview mirror and everything's fixed. And in reality, if you really look at what happened, they kind of kicked the can down the road. They printed a bunch of money. They introduced the danger of inflation that never materialized, or at least it didn't materialize yet, which really emboldened regulators that they could do whatever they want. And without the consequence of inflation that we're now quickly learning is in fact not the case, that the natural laws of, you know, economics actually do exist. But, you know, essentially what the Fed was saying is that we will not allow the market to crash. And they seduced themselves with this idea that they were heroes, that they saved us. And they, you know, they love that idea. I think the markets like that idea too. So instead of saying this was a one-off, once in a, you know, this is like the Great Depression, this is a once in a century event that we came in with emergency mandates, we intervened, we interfered with free markets, we disrupted the natural order of things, but we did it to the benefit of everyone and now we're heroes. In reality, the bill never came due. And they kept pushing it forward. They kept rates low. They kept blowing these bubbles. They kept doing more forms of quantitative easing. And they proved that, you know, they're never willing to pay the bill for what they want to take today. So there's never a time where people say, you know what, now we can, you know, raise rate. Now we're willing to accept diminishing returns. Now that returns are all determined by the Fed, we're willing to take it now because we had such a great run up the last few years. No, people are greedy. Every year they want to have great returns. And they kept their foot on the gas when they should have been on the brake. And that happened for a long period of time, really since 2008. So, you know, now we get to this period where we've had 15 years of it and the market is so exhausted. Things are so overvalued. COVID comes, they ramp it up yet even further. And what do you do now? So what do you do now? Do you just keep going indefinitely or do you let the market find its equilibrium? Do we trust free markets? And clearly they don't. That, you know, they do not trust free markets. We will not allow the natural order of things to take place in the markets. And that means that what we have now is managed markets. When I say a closed door meeting of suits deciding if inflation or a banking crisis is the bigger concern, what I mean is when you know, Yellen and Powell and the other Fed governors get together and they decide, do we want to pause rate hikes because we're worried about the banking crisis, or do we want to continue rate hikes because we're worried about inflation? That's an arbitrary decision that's made by a few boomers behind closed doors. And that is what is determining market returns. It's entirely based on what the bureaucrats decide or what they prioritize instead of the way it should be. When I say we used to buy companies, well, the way it should be is you're investing in real assets. I'm not buying beta. I'm not buying the market. I'm buying Walmart because I think their business is very solid. Or I'm buying, you know, Costco, whatever the company is, any publicly traded asset, because I've done my homework and I believe in the company and I believe in the products. And they're producing a real tangible economic value. And, you know, a company is a machine that generates cash. I want to participate in the dividends of the future cash flows of this company. So I believe in this company, I'm going to buy it. But now we don't do that. Now all we do is we buy the idea that the Fed's going to pause rate hikes. That's the big bet. And it's ridiculous. I mean, it's, you know, it's sad. It's really sad because it will not work forever. It'll work. I mean, I'm sure it'll work for a long time still. Like I said, it's a bullish tweet, not a bearish tweet, but it will not work on an indefinite time horizon. It just can't. It's not possible. So, you know, I feel like we have built up in the West, in modern times, we've built up this incredible wealth over a period of, you know, I don't know, 150 years that has been based on the principles of free markets. And, you know, allowing entrepreneurs to build things and getting the red tape out of the way and just allowing free markets to take their course. And that is the reason why America and other countries have been so prosperous. And we're losing that. We're losing that because people don't want to allow, let's say, the S&P come down, or we can't allow a single bank in California to go bust. So we're giving up the idea of free market principles in favor of managed markets. And there are unintended consequences that come along with that, many of which we still can't even see.
Phil, maybe I can ask a question on that. You raise a profound point, and just a question on that. And in terms of holding period of securities and the casinoification of the market, just wanted to get your thoughts on the back of what you're saying, which I, you know, which you know, really is profound. Maybe just some of your thoughts on the fact that, if you know, we used to buy companies that, you know, I would assume that we should be holding them for longer, right? And there should be some detriment to treating vehicles like casino objects.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not against going to the casino, right? And if you and I want to bet on whether the Jets win on Sunday, there's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing wrong with a single day option if I want to make a bet on whether, you know, we're gonna rip into the close today or not. Like, I'm not, you know, I don't think we should prohibit people from making a short-term bet, but the whole point
is I'm long the Jets in that bet.
Well, let's see what they end up with a quarterback. But the whole point of this whole thing, right, the whole game here is, you know, providing capital for companies to be able to build products and services that are themselves going to generate cash flow. And we are so far removed from the point of capital markets. I mean, companies, you know, for the most part, the last few years, don't even have to generate a profit, right? They can show user growth or whatever and just keep raising capital at low interest rates. We are so far removed from the point of the whole thing, and the stakes are so high. The stakes are so high. Every American retirement account, every corporate balance sheet, I mean, everything is based on keeping this thing at these elevated levels. So, you know, we've gotten ourselves into something that clearly we have no way out. I mean, that's another tweet I once put out. I said, wars and ZERP, right? Zero interest rate policy. Two things that are easy to get into, but impossible to get out of. And we see that now. Raising rates to 5%, like I said, it's not a black swan event. It's not like an that's below the historical average. 5%, while you know, CPI is above that, is not fighting inflation. That's like doing the bare minimum you have to do to try to get inflation under the way. And if the banks can't handle that, right, if that is even too much for the system to handle, then we have a major problem in the system, and we do.
Isn't it kind of like heroin, right? Like, you know what I mean? You don't take the heroin addict and be like, yo, you're done. you know, ZERP is like that in the sense that we have to normalize rates, but to your point, you know, we're on this, this zero interest rate junk, so to speak. What is the correct prescription to get us, you know, get us healthy again? I understand we need to get back to normal, but you can't rip the Band-Aid off too quickly. It's just such a tough situation.
Yeah, it is. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I mean, I would say, you know, what you do about it is, you know, you go back in time and you don't get yourself into this problem, because now that we're in it, there's no way out of it. You're right. It is like heroin. It is like, you know, the market is addicted to low rates. You know, I mean, these are the public markets. It's even worse. It's even worse in the private markets. You know, private equity and commercial real estate have been, you know, feeding on these low rates for a long time. There's a lot of over the next 5 years, there's $2.5 trillion in commercial real estate debt that will mature. So, you know, and most of that debt is owned by small banks. So if they have to reinvest at higher rates, it's going to change everything. So I don't know. I mean, do you just cut it off immediately? Like you said, like in the case of a heroin addict, you can't really do that. You can't do that. But inflation is a tax on the poor more so than it is on the wealthy, right? I mean, the basic necessities, the cost of a banana, the cost of a roof over your head, are going up even higher than the luxury goods right now. So, you know, people who were on the short end of the economic stick are now even on the shorter end. And to say that, well, you know, we don't want to crash the financial assets that are, by the way, held by the wealthy in order to get inflation under control, which, by the way, disproportionately hurts the poor, is a really, you know, it's a really horrible policy. It's a regressive policy. But, you know, like you said, if you go too fast and you say, all right, well, you know, we're going to do a Volcker moment, we're going to hike rates 15% in one shot, that will crash the market. Now, you know, the question is, does it crash it to a level that it's eventually going to hit anyway? Because, you know, eventually it will find its equilibrium or not. That's a hard question. But there's you know, this idea of a soft landing is pure fantasy. There is no soft landing here.
And Phil, I just want to ask you, like on the topic of systemic risk, like the Fed hiking till something breaks, i.e. what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank. You, as a REITs investor, have been very vocal about people need to spend more attention on private REITs, and they have the potential to have an impact on the market like the FTX blow up if things go sour. You had a thread that I posted up at the top talking about it. Can you just elaborate on that point for me?
Yeah, and it's a little different than FTX. FTX, you know, obviously, you know, is a go to zero Ponzi. This isn't a go to zero, but these things are overvalued. There's this category of private REIT funds. So I talked about BREIT, which is the Blackstone version. There's also a Starwood version. There's a KKR. There's a whole bunch of them. And essentially, you know, they hold private REITs, right, which are real estate investment trusts that are not traded on the public market. So they're not marked to market. And the NAVs, the value of these things, is set by this appraisal-based system, which means it's lagging, which means there's no price discovery. And what's happened is these things have run up to levels that are pretty comical. You can do like an apples-to-apples comparison of the private REIT versus the public REITs and see what people are actually in the market willing to pay for them on a secondary market. You can manage for property type and geographies and different things, and you can come up with a number. And we've done that at Armada, and we think that these things are overvalued by 20%. And, you know, the real crime here is that the historical risk profile of these funds, because they're private market funds, they have something called volatility smoothing, or what Cliff Asness calls volatility laundering, right? Which is that the marks on these things, the NAVs, are set by humans over time on a lagging basis. So when the economy turns quick, they're very slow to react and slow to move. And it's given off the impression of a low level of volatility. It's had, in fact, a realized very low level of volatility. And now as portfolios are increasingly automated, and as, you know, funds and securities that go into those portfolios are increasingly done so, you know, through different software and automation that, you know, doesn't, you know, that just takes into account the historical volatility, a lot of investors in these funds that have been put in these funds are low risk, the lowest of low risk investors. So, you know, your proverbial widows and orphans. And a lot of financial advisors have used these products to, you know, almost as a ballast, as a you know, replacement for fixed income more so than equity. And we think that they're standing on a precipice of a 20% drawdown on the NAVs, which they, you know, they don't see coming. The funds have major, major liquidity issues. They've already had to gate the funds, meaning you cannot take out more than 5% a quarter from these funds. Blackstone has had to do this like one-off deal last quarter with UC Berkeley to put in, it basically gave them a preferential return deal to for them to put in $4.5 billion into the fund to meet some liquidity demands. I mean, there are real assets here that they can sell to come up with more liquidity. The problem is that the commercial real estate market is entirely frozen in terms of volatility with rates where they are. So there's no way for Blackstone to create that liquidity without taking a big write down and being able to get what the market is willing to pay for their properties. And what the market is willing to pay for their properties is very, very different from the appraisal-based NAVs that they're using to value these properties. So I hope I didn't go too deep into weeds, but you know, at the end of the day, Blackstone owns $128 billion of real estate in this fund. And if they're gonna fill even the gated amount of 5% a quarter of that, they have to come up with $25 billion of liquidity each quarter. It's not very clear to us how they're gonna be able to do so, especially not without selling properties at deep, deep discounts to where they're being marked today.
Hey, Phil, do you have an opinion on what the implications would be of selling properties at deep discounts? Like, is it just, okay, you got to take your losses, lick your wounds, and go on to something else, and all the investors, they take losses, or could it end up being a systemic problem?
It's not clear, because in the commercial real estate markets, the biggest buyers over the last several years have been these private REIT funds. So Blackstone, Starwood, KKR, they've been the biggest buyers. So you take the biggest buyer off the table, but not only that, you then say, okay, now you're the biggest seller. You turn the biggest buyer into the biggest seller, and you're a forced seller. You have to sell. And everyone knows that you have to sell. And anyone that might come in, you know, to provide that liquidity. So I might say, okay, wow, this is great. I could buy, you know, a $300 million apartment complex from Blackstone. I think it's worth $450 and I can get it for $300. That's great. I can't even finance it because all the banks that would otherwise finance it, they have their own problems now because of the rate difference. So it's very, very touchy right now. It's very, and Blackstone is out saying that there's no problem at all. They marked the NAVs up last month, up. And the divergence between the public REITs, between if you look at, let's say, VNQ and where Blackstone is marking the BREIT fund, is just getting, you know, laughably bigger and bigger, and something's going to give. And this is kind of the calm before the storm.
This sounds like, Phil, this sounds like The Big Short, you know, when there were huge losses, but then the banks were like marking up the position so that they didn't have to pay out to Michael Burry and others.
that sounds similar. Yeah. And that was probably my favorite scene in the whole movie because it was so real. And anyone who's ever traded in the markets knows that, you know, a lot of times you're on the right side of a trade, but, you know, you're not, it's not, nobody ever gets into a trade and immediately that's the point where the trade starts moving in your favor, right? And there's this pain and this moment of, you know, do I trust my stop losses? Do I trust my conviction? Do I, you know, what do I do? And I think that's the hardest part of trading and investing, is those times where the market's moving against you and you have to either, you know, you're going to have self-doubt, you have to either keep your conviction or, you know, stick to your risk management principles. I love that scene. I know exactly what you're talking about. I love that scene. And, you know, Burry puts on the whiteboard, like down, like whatever, 40%, whatever he was. And, you know, but he stayed with the trade. Of course, it worked out. That's not necessarily the best way to trade. I'm sure there are others that have held on to trades all the way down to their own demise. But it's a very tough thing for traders to have to deal with. In this case, I don't think a lot of people are actively trading this thing. There's no liquidity to short it. It's too bad, because if there was, then you can arbitrage it, basically trade away that delta, and you know, bring it in line. I mean, that's what you would do with an ETF. You'd be able to short it and then bring the fund back in line to what it's truly worth. And it's a very elegant, easy solution. In this case, you can't do that. So, you know, it's just basically people that are locked up into the fund that are stuck in it. They're trapped and they don't really have much alternative because they can't get their money out. So this is like a slow motion train wreck that we can all see coming. Yeah, I really don't see anything that they can do about it.
Phil, reading between the lines, what I'm hearing is that KKR and Blackstone have some epic Twitter threads ready. And when they run into trouble, they're going to post them and ask for a bailout.
They're going to ask for a bailout for sure. I'm sure they already are, right?
I mean, get ready. They're teed up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I wouldn't want to be Powell taking a call from John Gray when, you know, right before they blow up. And they'll probably get the bailout. They'll probably get the bailout. They'll probably get the rate cuts. They'll probably get it because that's just the way things have been going.
Just someone that focuses on REITs being in the ETF space, what is your view on REITs and just the housing market in general with the Fed raising rates as rapidly as they did?
Yeah, I mean, housing's in a tough spot. REITs are interesting because REITs, a real estate investment trust, you would assume it's real estate, right? But it's not, right? So REIT does not necessarily mean real estate. REIT is a tax treatment. And what that means is you've got all these things now that have been popping up as REITs that are kind of tangentially sort of kind of related to real estate, like let's say a data center or a cell tower or a senior housing facility, you know, different assets that are REITs. They're not exactly, it's not like getting the Case-Shiller index. I think home prices, you know, are elevated. And I think with people being able to come in and finance new purchases at these rates, that there has to be some sort of true up. What we do in our fund is we focus on residential REITs. And what that means is basically rental income. We think that if you have to be anywhere in REITs based on the macro environment, this is where you want to be for a number of reasons. The demographic trends, the supply demand imbalance, the occupancy rates, all of those favor rentals. And you know what we had in 2008 when we had a crash, we didn't have inflation to go with it. Right. So this is a little bit different and it's not clear, you know, real estate is still a very hard asset. It's a real tangible thing. And in an inflationary environment, they tend to do pretty well. So if we have a period where financial assets are coming down, but inflation is still elevated, I mean, that's going to be devastating to the public, to everyone, to us. But, you know, as far as real estate, you might see them hold their value more than a lot of people who are students of the 08 crisis might expect.
Phil, just on that point, you know, this is a part that I really do struggle with. Obviously, real estate, and Scott, I know we've done historical data on this, but Phil, you probably know as well, right? You know, through inflationary periods, the 70s particularly, real estate did well. But I just, you know, what I struggle to, you know, square off is I am saying this from a Canadian perspective, the significant run-up we've seen and just how low rates have been over the last 10 or 20, you know, 10 years really, right? And just how that will influence the nature of real estate acting as an inflation hedge going forward. That's the part I really struggle with because we've just come through such abnormal times with respect to low rates.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It's definitely going to have an impact. I mean, home prices, you know, the divergence between home prices and rental prices is another thing. Home prices have outpaced rental increases by, I think the number is 25%. I don't remember exactly. Colin Roche put out a great chart on this recently. Until rates can start coming down again, I would be very concerned about home prices. Now, you know, while rates should be, I mean, in my opinion, they should be higher, right? I don't think rates should ever exceed inflation. To me, that's a regressive tax that hurts the poor disproportionately. But the reality of the situation is that the Fed has proven over and over that they are biased towards lower rates, and there's no sense in fighting it. So rates will come down at the first opportunity for them to do so. At that point, you know, we might see a return to what it was before, which was you could just close your eyes and throw a dart at a stock or a property or whatever it is. You own a piece of the, you know, the great financial bubble and things are just going to keep going up. And you don't have to worry about it. I don't know, you know, how that happens and what happens to inflation going forward. I don't know. I mean, clearly a recession is deflationary and a lot of people are predicting that. I think inflation in general is a lot stickier and a lot slower moving than a lot of people have given it credit. You know, this whole time over the last 10 years where people say, look, there's no inflation. We can print all we want. There's no inflation. The whole MMT idea, you know, I think a lot of that was just people being impatient and not understanding that certain economic, you know, factors move quickly and certain economic factors move slowly and inflation moves very slowly. So it's very hard to tell. But yeah, there's no doubt. You're right. I mean, right now, you know, real estate is, more interest rate sensitive than it's ever been. And, you know, inflation is obviously correlated to rising rates, which is going to hurt real estate. So that is a very good point.
Hey, Phil, could I just ask you a question on multifamily while we're talking about it? Do you have a good insight on why you think multifamily construction has kind of diverged from overall construction? It seems like it's still pretty strong. What is driving that? Is it what's happened during COVID? It's like a follow through?
A little bit. It's a supply demand imbalance. And what COVID did was it increased the demand for housing. A lot of people, you know, needed an extra bedroom for an office or, you know, wanted to get a second home. And, you know, we saw the demand for homes increase, even, you know, normalized for population growth during COVID. So there's a little bit of an after effect there, but primarily it's the supply demand imbalance. And, you know, you got to remember one of the things that rising rates does is it makes it more expensive to do new construction projects. So, you know, when there's a supply demand imbalance, it's usually pretty simple. More demand comes in to meet the supply. But it is now harder to finance construction projects to create that supply because of high rates. So the existing inventory becomes more valuable, and that's what we're seeing.
Thank you.
Phil, maybe I just want to ask you just a really broad question. You know, you've been in the ETF industry for 15 years. Where do you see like trends for ETFs going in the future? And maybe how have things changed during, you know, your lifespan as an investor and a CEO of asset management firms for this long?
Yeah, I love the ETF space. The ETFs have been called the Silicon Valley of finance. And, you know, it's become more and more efficient and cheap to launch an ETF. And what that means is that if you have a really good idea, it's still very difficult to get through, you know, minimum asset levels to be able to distribute in certain ways. And there are some gates that are still up in the industry, but if you catch lightning in a bottle with the right fund at the right time, no matter who you are, you can do very well. Whereas a lot of the other financial assets are, you know, really sold within closed networks. ETFs are not. ETFs are open networks. So, so I love the ETF space. And what we've seen primarily over the last, let's say about 5 years or so, we've seen an increase in the sophistication of products that are out there. So for a long time, the SEC was not allowing derivative-based funds to come out. They are now. And that has allowed a proliferation of, different strategies that are either downside protected or, you know, defined outcome, you know, kind of more sophisticated option strategies, which is great for this market environment. A lot of interesting things. At the end of the day, there's, you know, the ETF market is several things. It's you know, fast money, retail stuff, quick, hot idea that's kind of very surface level. And then it's also, you know, more long-term buy and hold products. It's, you know, most people still think of them as just cheap beta, but it's really just a vehicle wrapper that could be used for anything. But more and more, we're seeing these sophisticated strategies break through. And I think that's a great thing. I think we need more innovation in the asset management space. You know, the idea that everyone could just buy a portfolio of a couple of Vanguard funds and do well, that's worked very well during, you know, the last market cycle. If we are shifting into a more value cycle and a more, a more dispersed correlation of underlying securities, then, you know, we'll see some of these other strategies start to work better. And I think that'll be a good thing for the market overall and for price discovery.
Go ahead, Scott.
Phil, I was wondering if you had an opinion on kind of what happens to, say, mutual funds versus ETFs. Like, do you think most mutual funds will eventually end up converting into ETFs, or ETFs are just going to take their assets, or like, where does all the new money come from for the ETF space?
There's been a move to convert mutual funds to ETFs that's been happening. There's a couple little things that favor ETFs, and they're not the biggest things in the world, but you know, mostly it's this I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but basically ETFs are more tax efficient than mutual funds. So in a mutual fund, if I sell my shares of a mutual fund, the other shareholders get the capital gain that comes from the sale. So, you know, a portfolio manager bought a stock at 50, now it's at 100. I sell my mutual fund shares, the portfolio manager has to sell the stock. That creates a capital gain that gets distributed not to me, but to the other people that I left behind in the fund. And with an ETF, there's a mechanism to clean out that capital gain where you don't have those same capital gains. And what, you know, it's a small feature, but it really does favor the ETF. And in an environment, if we get to this point where there's a real unwind of mutual funds, then it's going to become a bigger and bigger issue, because the more mutual fund sales there are and the fewer people that are left in a mutual fund, the bigger the tax hit to them is going to be. So we're starting to see now some mutual funds convert to ETFs. I think it's, you know, I think that's a good thing. I think they're a little bit more efficient, a little bit better for investors. At the end of the day, the wrapper is not nearly as important as the strategy itself. You know, the key risk here with ETFs is, will there be enough market makers that can support all the products that are coming or would come to market? If every mutual fund today converted to an ETF, I don't think we'd see very good quality markets from the market makers, just because they'd be overwhelmed by the amount of funds and the amount of capital required to keep tight spreads in all those funds. So, you know, there's always unintended consequences and other risks, but the trends are pretty clear. You know, investors favor the ETF. The ETF is the best vehicle for the modern investor in not every instance, but in almost every instance. If you really kind of dig down and you know, run the numbers on the tax implications and the, you know, the cost to manage them, the ETF is almost always the preferential structure.
Thank you. That's helpful. Can I just ask about some of the structures that have been coming out lately? I know that they're getting kind of more and more, less and less diversified. I'm wondering, do you think right now people understand, they seem to think of ETFs as you always have liquidity, you know, because you can always trade them every day. But there are sometimes assets underlying the ETF that aren't as liquid. Have you seen any vehicles that have gotten to the point where, you know, it could be some really illiquid security, where even though the ETF's trading all the time, if we really had some market stress, the way ETFs work, for anyone who doesn't know, is you can take delivery of the securities. So that's why they said there's always liquidity. But if this isn't a liquid security, you still have to sell it if you want cash. And if you're selling it, how big of a loss do you take? Have you seen anything that would make you nervous in the ETF space, or it's still overall pretty liquid where, you know, only the worst case scenario could something like that happen?
We haven't had a lot of those types of situations. The SEC is pretty careful about what they'll allow in an ETF. They look at the liquidity of the underlying instruments. So if you want to do, let's say, a futures contract, a lot of this came up when firms were trying to do Bitcoin and different crypto strategies. The liquidity of the underlying is very critical to the SEC in their evaluation of what they'll allow. However, in an extreme market environment, particularly in fixed income, where there is no where there is no liquidity in the underlying for whatever reason, that will impact the ETF. And we saw that if you look at the beginning of COVID, right, when at the height of the panic before the Fed came in, fixed income ETFs were trading outrageously out of line. The spreads widened up dramatically. The market makers couldn't get liquidity in the underlying. So if they made markets in the ETF, they're taking on a lot of risk. And that was a moment in time where nobody wants to take risks. All these different risks, they're always correlated. They always happen together, right? Everyone, all the risk managers always look at them independently, but it's always one feeds off the other. And that's what happened for a brief time. And then, you know, the Fed came in and saved the day like they always do. So it's something that investors absolutely need to be aware of, particularly, I would say, on a fixed income side. If you're investing in an ETF of, you know, that's got underlying derivative use, you want to make sure you understand them, understand the liquidity of the derivatives. In most market environments, you're going to be just fine. And in panicked market environments, you probably would be better off not trading anyway, right? That's not when you want to be executing ETF trades, but it's something you absolutely need to be aware of. And if you are trading during, you know, market dislocations, I would say do so with extreme caution and do so with an understanding of what the underlying, you know, what the ETF is actually worth in real time based on the underlying holdings.
Great. It's good to hear that the SEC is not just letting any ETF kind of be launched.
What do you think? But then you look at things like the inverse Cramer tracker ETF, and it's kind of just like, do you think there people aren't really like? It seems like people are just launching like meme ETFs or like troll ETFs. What's your outlook on that? Like, do you think the market's getting oversaturated in ways or?
No, I love that. Look, I mean, you know, there's no reason why we can't have a sense of humor, right? And I think anybody buying the inverse Cramer ETF is probably having a hell of a lot of fun doing so. I don't think, you know, that's anybody's, you know, that's not the nest egg of an 80-year-old widow, right? That is probably somebody's risk capital that they're playing around with and enjoying. And, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if it performs well either. And I think that's great. I think people should be able to express themselves. We don't have to take ourselves too seriously. Right. And I think there's something for everyone in this market. And ultimately, at the end of the day, the market decides what ideas are valid and what aren't. So if a fund is out there and, you know, there's no market interest, and, you know, every fund has a market environment in which it will do very well commercially and performance wise, and a market environment in which it won't. So in most cases, if an issuer launches a fund and it doesn't do very well commercially, you know, a lot of times it's like, well, you know, we're waiting for a performance win, or we're waiting for the zeitgeist to turn, or the story to play out, or whatever it is. If a fund has that, they have the right market environment, and they're still not gathering any assets, you know, it'll most likely it'll close down, right? Nobody, this isn't a charity, and people, it costs money to run these things. So, you know, the market is self-optimizing that way. Anything that doesn't have its market, doesn't have its validity, is going to go away. But I think the idea that there's something for everyone, and that, yeah, there's some silly stuff out there. There's some stuff I probably wouldn't buy, but, you know, let's not infringe on anyone else's right to, you know, launch or buy what they think is good. And I think, you know, the Nancy fund, I think that's hysterical. I love it. I think it's funny. And I think, you know, people should be able to, you know, have a good time with their funds too.
David, go ahead.
I was just curious, Phil, seeing as you alluded to the differences between mutual structures and ETF structures, how limited are ETFs within their prospectus? Obviously, we know that a lot of mutual funds have a lot more flexibilities in reorientating certain structures, especially in consideration to beneficiaries and their demands to profit and asset allocations. Whilst in an ETF structure, I think that you have, correct me if I'm wrong, a fairly limited ability to maneuver outside of your prospectus.
As it should be. You know, if I call my fund a muni bond fund, and I decide there's an opportunity to buy silver, and I go long silver, right, and somebody thinks that they're in muni bonds, like the ETF has to stick to its mandate because allocators are relying on the ETF to do what it promised. So it may or may not be a good idea to buy a particular ETF, but I, as the allocator, am making that decision. I, as the issuer, am implementing, you know, what I promised. So I think that's a good thing. I think that's important. You know, if I say that my fund buys the, you know, it's a momentum equity fund, and I buy the top 25 equities based on my momentum signal, and then I decide one day, I say, you know what, I think we're moving to a value cycle, I'm just going to switch to value. Well, somebody else in their model allocated to my fund because they disagree with that. They think that momentum is about to be big, and then I randomly put them into a value strategy. I think that would be very problematic. So I like the idea that funds are held to the standard that they're, you know, what they're stating to their mandate. I think that's important. And, you know, look, if you want to do a macro fund, if you want to do a go anywhere style fund, you want to say, this is, you know, the Phil Bock fund, and I have total discretion to do whatever I want, state so in a prospectus, and then the investors know what they're getting.
Hey, Phil, Mark and I were at a Bloomberg conference 2 days ago, and one of the, you know, one of the topics, Eric Balchunas, you know, was leading the panel, and one of the topics was just about the ETF. Let's use the example of a fixed income, you know, emerging market bonds or something with low liquidity underlying, but the ETF has greater liquidity than the underlying, which, you know, help me understand that, because I just thought that was just wild, right? And I know you mentioned that, you know, like, there's the opportunity to close that gap, but it just how should I conceptually think about an ETF that has much greater liquidity than the underlying securities that it's representing?
It's really interesting, isn't it? So, like, price discovery will happen where price discovery follows liquidity. And whatever vehicle or instrument has the most liquidity is where people are going to bet. That's where they're going to determine the price of the asset. So let's say, for example, that, you know, the Egyptian stock market is closed during the Arab Spring, or the Greek stock market is closed during their crisis. But there's an ETF in the U.S. that's traded by, I think one of them was like VanEck, like some, you know, ETF issuer has a fund that's trading in the US. All the investors that want to bet one way or the other on that asset, they have a place where they can do so. That becomes the vehicle of price discovery. And if you think about it on another level, every single day, the Asian markets close overnight here in the US, right? And then the ETFs for those markets open up with the US market. So if there's news or something that impacts the value of one of the Asian markets while those markets are closed, you'll see, just like you'll see the futures move, you'll see the ETF move accordingly. And you know what you're seeing is you're seeing price discovery happen at the ETF level. And I think it's great. I think it's cool. If there was another vehicle that was more liquid than the ETF somewhere else, that's where that same price discovery would move to. But ultimately, price discovery is going to happen wherever the most liquidity is. And if in a particular asset at a particular time that happens to be the ETF, then that's where it is.
Fantastic. Thank you. That was a great explanation.
And I just want to pivot now, because we only have about like 15 minutes left. And if anyone has any more questions on ETFs, please feel free to come up on stage and ask Phil your questions. But I just want to focus more on the entrepreneurship side of yourself. You know, you've started up multiple ETF-related asset management firms. You're an advocate for startups. And you recently wrote a Substack titled Trough of Sorrow. I'm just interested if you could like talk to us about your experience of being an entrepreneur, that journey and kind of why you chose that title, and maybe what's your advice for people running a startup or maybe wanting to launch their own ETF?
So history is told by the winners. And when people talk about entrepreneurship, generally speaking, you're going to hear a fireside chat with the founder of Uber. You're going to hear a podcast with the founder of, you know, with Zuckerberg talking about Facebook or whatever it is. You're going to hear these triumphant stories of winners. And in reality, the winners are not the majority in startups in any case. And even those winners, even the ones that have been very successful, you know, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, right? But a startup is not a straight line, right? And there were days, almost certainly, unless they, you know, were truly a fluke, there were days early on where I'm sure they've had doubts or where things didn't go well and they had some setbacks. And, you know, I've tried to be very transparent about, you know, people talk about, oh, let's build in public. Everyone wants to build in public. Well, yeah, they like to build in public when things are going well, and then things are not going well, they stop building in public, you know. But I try to do that and to share the good and the bad. And I think it's important for anyone who's thinking about entrepreneurship, because it is very, very difficult. And everyone has setbacks. And if you're not doing it for the right reasons, if you're not doing it because you truly love it and you're, you know, you're ready for the fight and you're ready, you're gonna, you know, plow through whatever happens, if you're not doing it for those reasons, don't do it. Don't do it, because it's not going to be, you launch and one day and everyone loves the product, and the next day and all of a sudden you're this big success. It is not a linear straight line. You're going to have a hard time. It's everything is stacked against you. The bigger companies have more, you know, more resources, more assets. People are going to copy your idea. Everyone's going to come after you. If you're successful, they're going to, I mean, you have to build that moat quickly. It's very, very hard. So the trough of sorrow is a concept that Paul Graham put out, and he put out this graph, the life of a startup. And it's like, here you are in the middle, and then all of a sudden you launch and everyone's so enthusiastic and excited and it spikes up, and then reality sets in and you sink down to the trough of sorrow. And then you've got like this long period where you're kind of like up and down, but you're, you know, you're iterating and you're fighting through. You're trying to, you know, you've got this team, you're trying to get the right team, you're trying to find product market fit, you're dealing with all these different things. And then all of a sudden you hit this upside of the curve, and he calls that product market fit. And that's when people start buying your product. And then all of a sudden it switches to scale, and that's where you get the hockey stick, right? And that's where everything starts. You know, you're scaling, everything's working, you're humming, you've already worked out all the kinks in the trough of sorrow. And I was talking about the trough of sorrow in relation to my last venture. And, you know, the early days were very hard. And then we started to find some success in one of our product lines. And we kind of were crawling out of it right at that moment. But I think it's important to talk about, because, you know, a lot of people get advice, oh yeah, I have this idea. And everyone's just like, yeah, you should do it. You should definitely go for it. Be an entrepreneur. And I don't think that's necessarily the right advice. I think the right advice is it's going to be hard, and it's going to be harder than you think. And it's going to take longer than you think. And it's going to be a lot more stressful than you think. So either be in it for the right reasons and be willing to fight through that, or don't do it. Save yourself the trouble and don't do it. And the people that are willing to fight through it and do that, I think should be entrepreneurs, but they have to understand that it is, you know, it's not going to be a cakewalk.
And I look at someone like you, who, you know, is the CEO of Armada ETF Advisors. You're also a strategic advisor at Civics. And then you also have your own Substack, which is amazing. You write there every week, click on it. It's Backstack on Substack. But how do you time manage? Like, because you have a lot of different roles on your plate.
Yeah, I, you know what? If anyone has some advice on that, I'd love to hear it. I'm not very efficient, not very good with my time. I've got this system that I've had for the last, really, since I started working professionally for the last 15, 20 years, which is so ridiculous. I've got my little post-it notes of my like things today, and then I've got my little pieces of paper, and then I've got my Google Doc of my to-dos, and it's kind of like three stages. And if you saw my desk right now, you would say, this is a crazy person. Get him in a mental institute. Like, I've got little notes all over, little reminders. I do have ADHD. It's very, very, I have a very bad process, and I would love to have a better process. So I don't know. I'm over 40 years old. I've been doing this for a while, and I'm still trying to figure that out. But, you know, I try to keep, always top of mind the big things, right? What are the big things that have to get done? And I'll share one other thing. One lesson that I learned from my last startup is, when at the end of the day, afterwards, when I was kind of thinking back and looking back on it, I realized that I had spent a lot of time caught up in the minutiae and the day-to-day. I mean, there's always, you know, look, you start the day, you turn on your computer, emails start coming in, calls start coming in. And I felt like I didn't enough keep my eyes on the bigger picture. And that's something that I'm really trying to fix now, and really spend a lot of time just thinking, you know, without working, a lot of times trying to stay focused on the big picture, what our overall narrative is, the overall direction of things. And if that means that a few emails don't get answered as timely as I'd prefer, or if a couple small things don't get done, I'm willing to make that trade-off. But I don't have a good work process at all. I wish I did. I really do.
It's about getting up and fighting every day.
That's right. That's just right. Exactly.
Put on the gloves and go another few rounds. Now, Phil, I know we got Mike Venuto from Tidal in the audience, and I just want to ask, with respect to independent ETF providers, you know, going against these massive, feels like faceless kind of, you know, juggernauts, like the BlackRocks of the world, right? And how do we, you know, maybe you can help talk about the opportunity of these entrepreneurial ETF startups, independents, and, you know, what the advantage is particularly right now, in the era of social media, and I would love to get your thoughts and you know, why we believe we can win the fight versus these guys.
Yeah, if we could invite Mike up, he'd be the perfect person to answer that. I mean, look, at the end of the day, you have to be that much better. You have to connect with people. You have to give people a reason to care. If I'm running one of the largest asset managers, my main goal is to make sure that everyone thinks I'm okay and that nobody hates me. Right? You can't afford a PR hit. You can't afford to be, you know, to alienate or ostracize people. But if I'm an independent, all I need is 1% of the investment public to be like, I love this guy. This is my guy. This is my company. I want to work with them for whatever reason. It doesn't take a lot of people to feel that way. And if the other 99% of investors say, oh, what an asshole, I don't want to work with him, that's okay. You have to be willing to find your 1,000 true fans, right? Is another great concept from the VC world, where if you have a small but dedicated following of people that really like what you're doing, you will be successful. But I'd love to hear Mike's thoughts on that.
It's kind of cool to be the background on this one, hearing Phil talk through everything, because in the end, I'm the one who acquired his business, and we've got a successful partnership on new ones. So pretty full circle. And I, even going further on the full circle, I've been out there getting everybody I know to listen to Phil's latest podcast, because I think it answers the question that you just asked. And he did it with Doomberg, and the name was Provocative, Not Polarizing. These small ETF issuers can say things. They can be authentic. That sells. That's been what we've seen to be the greatest success stories of entrepreneurs we're helping launch. They have their message. They're authentic about it. They're provocative, and they're not polarizing. The irony is BlackRock has been polarizing, right? They went all in on ESG, and they created an anti-ESG movement. Like, that's polarizing. So I think of groups in our universe, you know, Phil and Armada's with us. you know, Auerbach is always out there with more information. When we talk about what's going on with BREIT, it's not, hey, these are evil people. It's, hey, you know, this is what happened, and here's how you get out of it. And here are real people who have run real REITs and, you know, are true experts and can actually give you information. Education, information, authenticity, all of that sells. I mean, we have people like Bob Elliott from HFMD. I've never seen somebody do everything so right in launching an ETF, and it's because he's authentic. And then we have ones on the other end of the spectrum. Like, you could say what you want about Meet Kevin and his PPE thing, but he caters to his audience and he stays to his story. And honestly, I looked the other day, out of the 77 funds we touch, he's got the best performance of any of them year to date. I would not have guessed that. Right. So the competitive advantage for a small ETF issuer is passion, authenticity, true knowledge of their subject matter. You guys know these growth themes, these disruptions at a reasonable price, unlike anyone else. Phil's team knows REITs unlike anyone else. I would trust you guys or Phil or even me, Kevin, for the things that you care about more than some index creation at Vanguard or iShares that only cares about, you know, the basis points. So that's the short answer.
Well said, Mike. Well said. It's, and it really is authenticity. And I know Margo, you know, Margo was telling me about the Doomberg, the podcast. Margo, and she was giving me the Coles notes for when I was like, this is incredible. Like what Doomberg has accomplished, and maybe, you know, Phil, you can, give a little primer on that. But I, you know, we obviously, you know, we've been fortunate to follow Doomberg in his rise, and he's been a core feature in our conference series, disruptive and commodity conference series. But I, you know, it's just been remarkable the franchise he's created, and without one interview in mainstream media.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, so I had the opportunity to interview him for the podcast, and I'm making a list of topics I wanted to ask about. And I started, you know, I think his posts are great, and, you know, talk about energy policy and, you know, different macro events, different investing events. And I'm like, you know what, this person came in, or these people, there's a group of them, came in out of nowhere and executed such a disciplined, data-driven approach to content. And everyone is doing content. Everyone's trying to, I felt like they did such a good job in their execution. I was like, you know what, forget all the macro stuff. I just want to ask about that. And I think I was fortunate, and anyone who's interested in it and wants to listen, we're all very fortunate that, you know, they've chosen to be entirely forthcoming in their process and how they execute. And, you know, hopefully people get a lot out of that conversation.
Yeah, I found it beautiful and also frustrating because I want to be able to run my business that way. But the truth is entrepreneurship is somewhat chaotic. We have our ups and downs, and we're always pivoting. Like everybody looks at what we do here at Title now and says, oh, overnight success. You know, we almost went bankrupt twice. And so it is I like it as the idea of perfection. I would like to strive to do what Doomberg does. And that's hopefully enough. Oh, and by the way, if anybody talks to him about wanting to launch an ETF, we're here. We'd love to do something with him.
For sure. Well, thank you, Michael, for coming up on stage. And for those that don't know, we have the podcast posted on up in the Nest. Doomberg gave a masterclass on content and business strategy. If you haven't checked that out, please go check it out. It's up on Spotify and was a great listen. But I just want to thank you, Phil, back for coming on today and talking about, you know, the hardships, what it takes to be an entrepreneur, as well as, you know, how to start an ETF and just your wealth of knowledge in that space. If no one else has questions, we will close the space, but feel free to come up and ask Michael, Phil, Scott, myself, or Thomas and David any other questions on ETFs or entrepreneurship, please do.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. You know what we'll have to do? We'll have to do another space just like, you know, really on the mechanics of just, you know, all of, you know, on the ETF, like do a full episode on the whole ETF entrepreneur side of it, right? It's just fascinating. I just feel like we're on the verge of something incredible. Obviously, it's not without pitfalls and challenges, as Mike said. You know, there's bumps along the way, but you know, it's the heart and the energy and the passion.
That's right. That's well said. That's well said. And that's a great place to leave off. Thank you guys. This is a lot of fun.